This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Kinnairy. Thanks for joining us. Another week of our collective response to the new coronavirus has passed, and the rate of new cases is staying relatively stable and apparently at a pace that's not currently overwhelming hospitals here in Southwest Florida. Since last week, there have been 192 new confirmed COVID-19 cases in Lee County, 97 new cases in Collier, 72 new cases in Charlotte County, 26 new cases in Hendry County, and Glades County is now reporting 6 cases. That's up 1 from last Monday. In all, there have been 69 coronavirus-related deaths across Southwest Florida, 101 if you include Sarasota County. Overall, the Florida Department of Health's COVID-19 data and surveillance dashboard puts the latest number of confirmed cases in all of Florida at 32,138. That's up from 26,660 last week. The rate of increase has stayed about the same statewide for the past 4 weeks, at about 6,000 per week. We've been talking with representatives from Lee Health and NCH Healthcare System on Mondays since the social distancing guidelines radically changed all of our worlds about a month and a half ago. On today's show, we're going to start out by checking in with the hospital in Hendry County, which reported its first two COVID-19-related deaths last week. We're joined by R.D. Williams, CEO of Hendry Regional Medical Center in Clewiston. Mr. Williams, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
And we've also got on the line Hendry Regional's Marketing Director, Alecta Waddell. Alecta, thanks for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we are live today, so if you'd like to ask a question, there's a post for this show on the WGCU Public Media Facebook page. Put the comments in or questions in there. We're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL on Twitter. So for starters, tell us about the Hendry Regional Medical Center. Like, how big are you guys? How many beds do you have? Just paint a picture of what your facility's like.
Well, Hendry Regional is a small rural hospital classified as a critical access hospital. So we operate 25 acute care beds. We also operate two rural health clinics, one in Clewiston and one in LaBelle. And those two primary care clinics each have six providers in them. And then we have a number of other clinics here in the Clewiston area with primary care physicians and specialty care physicians that we try to provide services to our area here in Hendry County and southern Glades County.
Do you have ICU beds there, or if somebody requires what we know of as an ICU bed, would they have to be transferred to a different hospital?
We do have ICU beds. We're staffed to be able to take care of critical care patients. We have ventilators to support people if that's necessary. Full-service emergency department, laboratory, and imaging as well.
So overall, how has the response to the new coronavirus been going at your hospital? What's the overall tone there like? How are supplies holding up, things like that?
Well, we've had to make a number of operational changes, as have our larger brethren on either coast. We've modified how people can enter the facility. We have no visitation. Everyone entering our facility has a temperature check. They must be wearing some type of simple cloth face mask or other type of medical face mask, whether it's in the hospital or in our clinics. We've seen a pretty dramatic decrease in volumes in our clinics as well as in our emergency department and in our regular hospital business also. I think many folks are staying at home and not seeking out care as they normally would if the virus were not here. We're concerned about that. We hope that people are taking care of themselves and that they're not waiting too long before they seek out care. But we're here and available to see folks. We've been very fortunate with our PPE supplies. Our Emergency Operations Center here in Hendry County has been very proactive in securing supplies and distributing them to not only our facility, but the long-term care facilities here in the county. We've also had some generous donations from folks like U.S. Sugar and others in our area to help with the PPE supplies. But other than that, we're making it along. People are tired. It's a real burden, and to keep your attention really on high level to make sure that there aren't any breaches in infection control practices. You want to be able to protect yourself and protect all the patients as best that you can.
How many patients have you treated for COVID-19, and are you treating any right now?
Yeah, we have four positive COVID patients in our hospital at the present time. We've probably seen a total of 35 to 40 positive patients in our facility.
The two people who have passed away from COVID-19 related stuff out in Hendry County, were they patients that you treated?
They were not. Those individuals actually were not ever seen at our facility. They were seen at other facilities or actually died outside of a hospital.
Understood. Are you able to do testing as people come in with possible cases there, or do you have to send tests away, or just how does that work?
Well, we're able to collect specimens for testing at various laboratories across the state and region. We do not have the ability to do the microassays that some of the larger hospitals are able to do, but now that the testing has become much more widespread in the regional reference laboratories, the turnaround time is 24 to 48 hours in most cases, and so we've tested several hundred folks over the course of this crisis and really have very few tests outstanding at the present time.
Is there a mobile testing going on out in Hendry County anywhere?
No real true mobile testing. I know that the health department has stood up a couple of testing sites at their two offices here in Hendry County that they welcome folks to come in and drive in with a physician's order for testing. And then at our primary care clinics and at the rural, the other federally qualified health centers here in the county, we do what we call curbside testing. Someone will contact us, we'll talk through the symptoms that they may have, and instead of bringing them into the office, we actually will gown up and get prepared and go out and do a further interview, and if the symptoms and everything are there, we will collect the specimen with the patient without them ever having to leave their vehicle.
Generally speaking, what's it like out in Clewiston right now during all of this? Are people wearing masks in public and things like that?
We're starting to see it more and more. I think the resident population is pretty adherent to the wearing of masks. We do have a lot of folks here this time of year that are working in the harvest operations within agriculture, and many times they have to be reminded and helped with finding an appropriate face covering. But for the most part, I believe that the public's very aware of the need to wear masks and is in general compliance.
That was going to be my last question is, you know, does it seem like the farm worker community is being communicated with, you know, well enough in terms of what they need to be doing to protect themselves?
I know the Department of Health makes regular communications not only in English and Spanish and also in Creole in our area. I know that the farmers are communicating on a daily basis with their workers, and the harvest operations are all working at it very closely to checking temperatures and making sure that their workers stay safe.
Well, that is all the time we have. I really want to thank you. This is R.D. Williams, CEO of Hendry Regional Medical Center in Clewiston. Mr. Williams, thanks for your time. We'll have to check back in with you.
All right. Thank you.
Have a great day. We've been hearing a lot lately about antibody testing that's happening to try to determine whether someone has COVID-19 already. NCH Healthcare System recently is going to acquire, I think, or maybe they have already, we'll find out, some new equipment that will allow them to do much more of such testing. Joining me now to tell us more is John Kling. He's Chief Nursing Officer at NCH Healthcare System. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be back. Appreciate it.
And we are live today, so find the post for this show on the WGCU Public Media Facebook page to ask a question or make a comment, or go to Twitter. We're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So tell us about this new machine and whether you have it now or you're expecting to have it soon, and then we'll talk about what it can do.
Sure, Mike. Thank you. So we have actually purchased this machine. The lead time is about 3 weeks or so. So we're expecting it to be on site and operational by the end of May. So that was, you know, we're trying to be conservative with our timelines, but that's what we're, you know, shooting for. And really kind of what, you know, for your listeners, antibody testing is essentially what antibodies do is a human being's response to protect itself from viruses and bacteria. And by testing of antibodies, it gives medical professionals, physicians, and clinicians the ability to kind of investigate a patient's history of infection. Have they been exposed to infection? or have they been any immunity that's been built up to that? Now, COVID-19 is a new novel virus, so the antibody testing is still being developed. And what NCH did is we waited for a device that was FDA approved. There's been many devices that are on the market that people are saying they're doing testing, but they have not been approved. So when you look at, antibodies, total antibodies and specific antibodies is what we can do. And that's what we're kind of looking at doing going forward. And really with what this will do will allow us to do 1,000 tests a day at the beginning. And we're going to upgrade some more of our equipment to do up to 2,000 tests a day. And, you know, appropriate antibody testing that's been approved by the FDA will, you know, allow a physician to investigate a patient's clinical history, and as well as this will be in conjunction with PCR, which is the nasal swab testing, and, of course, the physician's clinical assessment. So those three key factors are what's going to allow us to say, okay, John Klink, for example, is, you know, he's either A, been exposed to the virus, B, maybe has some immunity built up to it, and C, does not have it, and D, is clinically asymptomatic and no symptoms, so we think that we can, John can go back to work. So that's kind of the premise, and really what NCH really wants to do is be a regional leader and assist all the healthcare professionals in our community and also our business owners and their employees to get them back to work so we can get back to our new normal as soon as possible.
So this
kind
is
kind of a very complicated process, but
yeah, well,
sorry, Mike,
no, that's okay. So this is FDA approved, not one of the emergency use authorization approved. Is this one of the first? Do you know if this is the first one that's been approved? Because I didn't know there had been any approved.
So it's one of the first ones, Mike, and in EUA, emergency use authorization is part of the FDA process, and this has been approved by the FDA. So there's been, to my knowledge, there's been two. This is one of the only ones that I know of out there. There may be more that I know of out there that has a large volume capacity that we're looking for to look at testing all of Cuyahoga County. And people keep asking me, John, who do you plan on testing? And our answer is, once we get the ability, we want to test everybody. This is a community, you know, effort to get us all back to work and to be as safe as possible moving forward.
There was a lot of reporting over the weekend about WHO saying that at this point there's no evidence, like firm scientific evidence, that the presence of antibodies translates to some sort of immunity. Does that upset the balance of what you were just talking about in terms of giving people confidence that they can then go back to work, et cetera?
I think, you know, as I mentioned, this is a really new virus, and as the experts are out there doing their research and evidence is coming in, the assumption of possible immunity from this antibody testing, from results from this, is based on what we saw with SARS and MERS back several years ago. Those viruses had some, you know, had immunities from that from a year to 18 months and give or take some on some of those. So as that's why we say in our you know, press release and my comments to our public and to our employees, you know, we think based on past viruses that there will be an immunity that can come from this. However, it's not 100%, so I want to be very cautious. But I think when you look at total and specific antibodies, this is much better than what we have today, which is nothing. So we have chosen to, as soon as the FDA was approved on this device, to purchase it and start planning for large volume testing for Cuyahoga County.
Is it known how accurate this machine is in terms of, you know, false positives, false negatives, things like that?
So this is one of the good things about this machine is that it has a 99.1% positive, so it's called sensitivity and specificity, which is really, really pretty amazing. So, you know, we really wanted to wait for something that was approved that had good sensitivity and specificity before we went and started, you know, doing this, because think about that. If you were going to get a pregnancy test and you had a 30% chance of being wrong, why would you get the test? So we wanted to wait and get that strong clinical evidence test so we can run it.
How are things looking overall out there? You guys, supplies holding up, you know, beds available, things like that?
Yeah, right now our current bed capacity, we're at 60%, so we have about a 40% capacity in both of our non-critical care beds and our critical care beds. So plenty of beds still, plenty of ventilators. We're seeing really a kind of a leveling off of of our cases. We have done, now we have the capacity to do more in-house testing, which is a good thing. So right now we have a total of 21 positive COVID patients, but only a total of 6 PUIs, which is a person under investigation. So, you know, in the past Mondays, we've had, you know, up to 30 to 50 PUIs, but now that we're doing more in-house testing, we're able to rule those patients in or out for COVID-19. If they rule out, then we can save the personal protective equipment, all those isolation, you know, gear that we're using. And then that's why you're seeing a little bit higher number than we've had. We've been around 12 to 14 from positive cases. Now we're at 21. And that was to be expected. With more testing, we're going to see more positive cases. So in answer to your PPE question for supplies, we have a really good supply of everything. What we're looking really hard at now is our isolation gowns. That seems to be an opportunity for us right now with the supply chain. So we're working really hard to obtain and secure more isolation gowns, but we're good as of today. But we want to be prepared for whatever comes up in the future.
Okay, and just to clarify before we let you go, and you may have already answered this, but I wanted to re-ask it. So if somebody, once this machine is up and running, if somebody comes in and you suspect they might have it, will that be just the PCR test, or will this test also be applied to somebody who is a suspected case?
So this is the antibody test is a serology test, and that's a blood test. So like you get your normal blood drawn from your from your arm site, your antecubital site. The PCR test is that nasal pharyngeal swab in your nose. So this what the antibody test will do is look at those the antibodies. Have you had those antibodies from the COVID-19, or do you have any presumed immunities built up to it? And that's why I said, the process would be if I came in and I wanted to be tested to see if I've been exposed to it, and if I have symptoms, then they would also do the PCR swab. So this is not the one and only, thing, but this is a game changer when you look at investigating a person's history and then helping them get back to work and helping the physician make a clinical decision. This is a good adjunct to that pathway and that plan of care for the patient or the diagnosis from PCR and assessment by the physician. Does that make sense?
Yep. All right. John Kling is Chief Nursing Officer at NCH Healthcare System. John, thanks for your time again. I'm sure we'll talk to you down the road.
My pleasure. Stay well.
And real quick, I have the latest numbers from Lee Health to get this into the conversation. They're currently treating 80 people who have tested positive. The rate of testing remains about the same, and they are keeping up with demand. Most testing is happening at their mobile test sites. Apparently, the supply of personal protective equipment is described as stable at this time. Overall, their five hospitals, they're at 62% capacity with 74 ICU beds available. 42 Lee Health staff members have tested positive, and 183 are currently self-isolating. Lee Health started working on a new trial last week that's being led nationwide by Mayo Clinic. It's exploring whether plasma extracted from the blood of people who have recovered from COVID-19 might be used as a beneficial treatment for people who currently have it. To learn more, we're joined again by its lead researcher, infectious disease Dr. Doug Brust. Dr. Brust, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Doing very well. And we're also going to bring another voice into the conversation right now. Got to press the right button. Sharon Esern is a molecular virologist and professor at Florida Gulf Coast University. Sharon, thanks for being here again as well.
Hi, Mike. Good to be back.
And so,
hey, Mike, before we get into the...
I was going to ask you to reflect on that testing stuff we just talked about, too. So go start from there, Dr. Brust.
Right. So we have to be very, very careful of our terminology in this, pandemic that's occurring right now. There are currently no FDA-approved in vitro diagnostic tests for detection of by either antibody or by some antigen or nucleic acid for SARS-CoV-2. That's the virus that causes COVID-19.
So
that means that the FDA has not reviewed data and said this is the sensitivity, specificity, and performance of this test. So there's no FDA-approved testing. The FDA has granted emergency use authorization that it can do during, an emergent pathogen that's occurring, an emergent disease that's coming in that we never had before. So this is a speed up. But when it grants emergency use authorization for a diagnostic test, what it says is that the manufacturer has to do its in-house, itself, has to look at sensitivity and specificity and report that out. But that does not mean that it's approved by the FDA, nor has that in-house sensitivity and specificity gone through rigorous testing by other facilities.
So it's been approved for use at facilities, but they have to report their data back to help refine the process even further in terms of what's known?
No. Not the facilities, the actual manufacturer.
Oh, right.
The FDA has to look at, the manufacturer is the ortho, which is making this, you know, Lee Health is going to have the same system up and running about 2 weeks, so for antibodies. But the manufacturer has done the sensitivity and specificity, the performance of the test. But the FDA has not looked at those numbers and said, yes, we agree. The FDA just said, you have to do this as part of your manufacturing procedure and will allow you to let institutions like Lee or NCH to use the antibody test with the knowledge that this is under emergency use only. It is not FDA approved.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
The other thing is that you do not use any antibody tests. The FDA is very has come out with a strong stance. No antibody tests are used for diagnosis of acute disease.
Only to check to see if maybe you've had it in the past.
Right. So if you come in like this situation that you suggested to us earlier, if the scenario is if you come into the hospital with acute disease or your doctor's office and you're sick, you do not get an antibody test.
Gotcha. We only have a few minutes left, so quickly remind listeners, give us the succinct version of this convalescent plasma trial, what the two parts are, and how week one is gone.
Okay, so first of all, thank you very much for asking about that. The convalescent plasma trial looks at taking plasma, a component of blood that has antibodies in it, from people that have completely recovered from COVID-19, and then transfusing that plasma into people that are, you know, acutely ill with COVID-19. And the question is whether or not they actually get better. And this has been demonstrated for other viral infections before. So there are two portions of it. The thing is that we have to get people to donate blood so we can make the plasma for people that have recovered. So I'm happy to say that last Monday we opened up, and we already have 8 units of plasma, and we're getting it rapidly. We've had quite a big interest. So if we could post maybe somewhere for how people can get in touch with us, if you've had COVID-19 and you've had a positive diagnosis, that means you had a nasal swab that was positive, and now you're better, and it's been at least 14 days, you can, you know, contact us if you're interested in donating blood that we would make plasma from.
We do have the link for this show on our website. It has the email address that you want people to email and the phone number that they can call, but you prefer the email, so just find that there. How many people have to donate in order to get those 8 pints of plasma or those 8 units of plasma?
It's one per one.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay. Let's see. We only have a couple minutes left, so I just wanted to ask a couple follow-up questions on that. I was reading up on these antibody testing. I mean, not the antibody testing, the convalescent plasma stuff. And then I was reading a doctor from the Boston University School of Medicine who said that there might be a chance that while it might benefit patients, they might not necessarily then acquire any kind of immunity that might be coming back if a person dealt with this on their own. Do you know what I'm saying?
So in other words, in recovery, if antibody is important to recover from this virus, so the question you're asking is if giving antibody early on somehow causes your own immune response to sort of short circuit and not make antibody,
right,
or be fooled. And that's why we're doing it in a clinical trial.
Understood.
So that's exactly one of the reasons, because there could be downsides to it. And we do not know that.
Understood. Okay, Dr. Sharon Esern, you know, we only have about a minute left, so I'm just going to actually have you hold on, and we're going to continue this after we end the show so for the website, because we just ran out of time too quickly again today. Dr. Doug Brust is an infectious disease doctor with Lee Health. Doug, thanks for your time. We'll talk to you in a couple minutes here.
Okay, thanks so much.
And thanks to our earlier guests, R.D. Williams and Alecta Waddell from Hendry Regional Medical Center in Clewiston, and John Kling, Chief Nursing Officer at NCH Healthcare System. If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kniary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers. Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida, and do check the web post for this show for our continued conversation. Okay, well, let's continue the conversation. Doug, just to follow up one last time, so when they were saying that there's FDA approved, they were saying that was FDA emergency use authorization approved.
Well, or granted. I wouldn't say
not approved. Approved is the imprecise word there.
Right, right. Are we live? What is?
No, this will be added to what people hear on the web.
Yeah, no. So using the word approved is a little bit problematic when you're talking about the FDA, because everyone thinks, oh, it's FDA approved. That means it's FDA has reviewed all. You submit data. Each manufacturer would submit their data, and then the FDA will look at it and make sure that it's rigorous data and that it's actually, you know, demonstrating what the manufacturer is saying. Right now, with emergency use authorization, they'll grant it to a manufacturer like Ortho, which is the manufacturer of the this antibody platform, and say, look, you're going to be required to do your own in-house sensitivity and specificity and other, you know, validation of this test. And we're going to allow you to use that as long as, you know, in good faith you're doing that. That's the emergency use authorization. But when it gets FDA approved, they're going to look at all that data and make sure that it's, you know, kosher.
Understood. Dr. Eastern, you know, there's been a lot of news this week about these places like New York City and Santa Clara out in California, where they're doing mass random testing, and it's indicating something like 1 in 5 residents are showing positive. You know, we've talked about false positives, false negatives. You know, what can you tell me about how that testing is being done and what researchers and doctors know with certainty about those cases?
So what these tests are looking for is they're looking to see if someone had been exposed to coronavirus at some point. And so it's looking for a patient's repertoire of antibodies, not necessarily whether the antibodies are going to be effective in preventing a second infection. So that's something that the World Health Organization has cautioned about. You know, we haven't verified that yet. That's still to come. And so what this is really looking for is exposure to the virus at some point. Now, I think these studies and the World Health Organization supports the studies as well, because they're critical for understanding the extent of infection, to see where is it, how many individuals overall in a population have been exposed. And so this helps with measures of trying to either prevent future infections or combating the outbreaks that are going on. And so just these numbers are, because many of the COVID cases are asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic or very mild symptoms, many people don't go and get tested. They don't go to the doctor. They don't go to the hospital. So they don't get tested for the presence of the actual virus, which is that PCR test that looks for the virus genome. And so many of these individuals that are now getting tested for antibodies were never tested for the actual, were they actually infected. But because many people are sub-symptomatic or asymptomatic, it's really possible that many more people are actually infected than the number of confirmed cases that are being reported. And so it doesn't necessarily surprise me that these numbers are coming out. I think they're saying 1 out of 5. I mean, that seems like within the range of possibility. Does not sound like an off-the-chart number. But more of these tests need to be done to determine overall what is the percent of the population that has been exposed. And again, then the next set of things to look at is, okay, so if you've been exposed, are these antibodies going to be protective to you as an individual if you get a second infection? And that's a completely different set of analyses that will need to be performed.
Are these tests, the antibodies that they're finding, do they know that these are the antibodies from this coronavirus, or is it possible that you would have antibodies that were similar to the kind that you would have from some other coronavirus that you maybe have gotten?
My presumption is that they're specific to the antibodies for this particular virus, and that they should have done quality control to show that serum from other, so when they're testing these kits, that serum from others that had been exposed to human coronaviruses or maybe even SARS or MERS, that that sera does not react to these tests. And so those are things that need to be validated beforehand, in addition to negative control serums. So people that have never been exposed, those need to come out negative. So that validation needs to be done before these antibody tests or kits are deployed. And that should be the standard of practice. But again, these tests are being put out there, issued sometimes with no emergency authorization use, or even with that doesn't necessarily mean that the data, as Doug was talking about, has been looked at beforehand by the FDA. These things are, they're putting it on the individual manufacturers to come up with their own quality control. And so we're going under the assumption that that has been taken care of, but that may not necessarily be the case.
Go ahead, Doug.
Big business. So this is the fox guarding the hen house, potentially. So, I mean, you know, there are many in vitro diagnostic tests out there, Sharon, that haven't even gotten emergency use authorization. So, I mean, they're just out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the FDA really put a stern warning out about using this for acute illness, because you develop IgM early antibody. You could use it for an acute case if it's been validated. But I was wondering, maybe, Sharon, do you know if there's any prevalent studies ever on other coronaviruses other than, I mean, just like common cold coronaviruses? Because if we're seeing 20%, I would say that would be good to know that if we did a prevalence, seroprevalence study for another coronavirus, it's a common cold, that we saw 80%. It would sort of make me feel more reassured that we're actually specific for the one we're looking at. Do we have to know that?
Yeah, I'm actually not aware of any studies done with others. Not that they haven't been done, I'm just haven't.
People just don't care about those viruses.
Right, exactly.
Well, let me ask you guys this. So we hear about, I think, is it the R number that says, you know, X, you know, like if a person, you know, will tend to infect X number of people. Is that the R number? Am I getting that right?
So
if we're seeing 1 in 5, even though only a small percentage of those ever get sick enough to get tested, does that mean that it's not as it doesn't hurt people as much, but maybe that R number is much higher than what we're hearing? Does that make sense?
It's a possibility, yeah, because if the cases are asymptomatic, people could be spreading, and we just don't know that that they're getting confirmed as positive cases. So that's a possibility as well.
So the look back epidemiologically is, you know, the data that are coming out that are actually, you know, pretty good, is that you're most infectious 2 days before you have symptoms. And, you know, that hasn't been completely validated with other studies. And that's very different than SARS, where you were most infectious based on, you know, epidemiological settings, 5 days after you were symptomatic. So that's a real problem, because if you're most infectious before you even develop symptoms, that's why, you know, it necessitates people having masks and socially distancing at all times, as if you do have it, because you wouldn't know.
I mentioned this earlier in the show when we were talking with John Kling about the WHO saying that at this point there's no evidence that people who've gotten it can't get it again. But I hear people respond to that. They think no evidence means that that's the case. But no evidence just means we don't know, right? That's just a big question mark. That's not giving any indication.
Debbie Burch walked that back at the forever entertaining presidential briefings.
Who walked it back?
Dr. Burch. She sort of said, you know, exactly what you just said. That doesn't mean there's not going to be.
Right.
A step in the right direction. We did, you know, what Sharon was talking about before is, you know, there's non-neutralizing antibodies. There's all different types of antibodies that you can develop and you can test for. And, you know, you need to look epidemiologically whether people can become reinfected or not.
Just in a couple minutes when we have left, Sharon, can you remind listeners, you know, we hear about SARS, that's severe acute respiratory syndrome, and MERS, Middle East respiratory syndrome. Can you remind listeners what they were, how similar or dissimilar they were to this coronavirus, and what happened to them?
So SARS, so that's for a severe acute respiratory syndrome. That's the outbreak was back in 2004 in China, and that the reservoir for that one was civet cats. And that was a very short-lived outbreak. Apparently the spread was not as efficient as it is with this current COVID-19 virus. A viral infection was lower in the respiratory tract as opposed to in the throat and mouth, where you could get, you know, quick spread, and it did not spread as quickly. So that one eventually died down as people were tracking down the cases and preventing exposure. And so they basically tracked all the cases and figured out, okay, who has it, and just quarantined them, and that stopped the outbreak of that one. MERS is a Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome that started back in 2012. And it had a peak in 2014. There were some cases all the way up to 2019, and that was first identified in Saudi Arabia in 2012, and it had an intermediate host that was a camel, and it had a pretty high fatality rate for those that were infected that actually died. It was like 34% or so, and so it was pretty severe, and that one was also contained. And so because it was it had such a high fatality rate, it's fairly straightforward to contain it. But what's going on, I think, with the current coronavirus is it spreads readily like any other human coronavirus, and there's a huge population that has never been exposed, and so there are hosts that can continue to spread even if they're asymptomatic, and it spreads quickly, as Doug mentioned, probably before they're even showing symptoms, even if they're going to be symptomatic. And so they're out there talking to people and spreading it, and it's easier to transmit than some of the other coronaviruses. But if anything that we've learned about infectious diseases and pathogens is they never truly go away. They have opportunities to come back, or new emerging pathogens can come back. And so the same thing with the flu, whether it's pandemic or seasonal, and there are different reasons for things to come back or not come back. For example, the virus can mutate, such as influenza. Doesn't seem to be the case as much, a high degree of mutation for this particular virus. For other viruses that are transmitted by mosquitoes or other vectors like ticks and other things, you can try to prevent spread by getting and controlling the mosquito population or the other, you know, the vector population. And so if there's a vaccine, that's the way of controlling viruses. But if there is no vaccine, but even if there is a vaccine, there's some countries out there that are not going to be able to deploy vaccines because of costs or other reasons or frail health systems. And so these pathogens will always be there. And with increased travel and the way that we can get from one continent to another in just a matter of hours, the spread of disease is going to be easier than it was centuries ago.
Doug, did you want to?
Can I bring Breuer off just one quick comment?
Oh, please, go ahead.
What Sharon said is that, you know, in 2003 when SARS sort of disappeared because it just disappeared. But it does, and correct me if I'm wrong, Sharon. It is still found in bats. I mean, it went back in bats, so it's still found in bats. So it could reemerge.
It absolutely, these viruses could reemerge at any point. So they're not gone. They're just, we just
hiding.
See them right now. They're hiding.
They have a place to hide. They're back. It's back in its second. It's either primary or secondary host of being in bats. The exact SARS virus, so it could come out.
What about the Spanish flu pandemic back in 1918? I know it's not a coronavirus, but it was very transmittable, and a lot of people died. How did it eventually settle down?
Guys, the BBC just had a great thing on the Spanish flu. They had a whole hour on, I don't know what day, I never know what day it is anymore. But they were reading testimony in the newspaper, and they had actors. It was pretty good. I'm going to let Sharon handle the Spanish flu. I just know about them.
I need to watch the BBC thing. Sharon, what can you tell us?
So I haven't watched the BBC. No, that's
not.
It
was on NPR.
But basically, I mean, with influenza, we have every year different strains that resurface, And so it changes very quickly, and there's when one dies down, then we get another one. And also at some point, you get enough individuals exposed that you have a strong enough herd immunity to prevent further spread. It could come back again when we now have a new population of people that who have never been exposed, and so that's an opportunity for the virus to make a comeback. But they never really go away. They just somehow, we don't see them. They disappear. They either go back to the reservoir host. I think at some point, similar to Zika, when enough of the population has been exposed and it's immune, it's more difficult for the virus to transmit when there are not as many hosts who can have a productive infection.
They're talking.
There's a book. They actually, from the 1918 Spanish flu, there were people that were buried in permafrost, and they've actually exhumed the bodies and were able to recover the virus and actually make the virus to look to see why it was so pathogenic. It's an amazing story.
Well, I think they weren't. They didn't get infectious particles. They were able to pull up the genome.
Right. Not infectious particles.
Yeah.
I meant they were able to, you know.
Thanks for that clarification.
The virus was not viable anymore.
They could never get a full genome.
Right.
They actually were able to just, you know, pattern it together. I mean, I just read the popular book, but it was really interesting. I mean, it was amazingly interesting.
Well, let me ask you this. I think Sharon's probably, but either one of you. So they're working on a vaccine for this new coronavirus. We don't really know how long that'll take or, you know, how it will work at this point. Are there other coronaviruses that we've developed successful vaccines for?
So right now, there's when you mentioned vaccines, there's 5 vaccine candidates in clinical evaluation. This is according to the World Health Organization as of April 20th, and 71 candidates that are preclinical right now, meaning they're not yet in human clinical trials. I'm assuming one of them will work. I mean, there's a lot of candidates. There's a lot of money being thrown at them, but what happens with time is interest wanes and finances wane when it no longer becomes a crisis. And I think that's been the case for other, for human coronaviruses in particular. They're really not that. There's just a common cold. For SARS and MERS, the market wasn't quite there. It just, these diseases died away. It did not affect that many people.
Okay.
So there's no money in pharma to really go after these candidates because it's, but now for this one, because it spreads so quickly, there's that potential and there's the interest right now. But what I'm kind of a little worried about is that interest will wane with time, just as people are becoming immune and it's no longer going to be a huge public health burden.
But generally speaking, we don't know with certainty how coronavirus vaccines work in the end, because we've never really made one before.
They're using technologies that have been used for other vaccines and new technologies that have been in the pipeline for other diseases, and also technologies that have been used for veterinary vaccines as well. So the technology is there. They're just what is kind of unknown at this point is what part of the virus is what we need to be targeting. So when we talk about antibody testing and the fact that we don't know if you have antibodies, if you're protected, the reason we don't know that is because an individual's immune response will actually make their own set of antibodies that may or may not be fully protective. They may not be the strongest, most potent antibodies. But when you create a vaccine, you want to make sure that you're putting the piece of the virus that is the most immunogenic, the one that is actually going to prevent the virus from infecting. And if we don't know what that is, then we could miss it. So people have ideas of what that is. Most of them are looking at the spike protein, which is the part of the virus that interacts with the cell on the way in as it infects the cell. But also the conformation or the shape of that protein is important because antibodies are really specific to 3D space and what they're touching. And even if you have the right sequence that you think it's the right sequence of the virus target, but if it doesn't have the right shape, it's not going to have the right function and it may fail. And so there's many opportunities for failure, even, you know, when you think you have the right thing to target. There are other things could happen along the way.
Hmm.
Right. And the real problem is that, I mean, we just do not know the nature. First of all, if you can even become immune to the virus, that's the first question we don't know the answer to. The second question is what the nature of immunity is. And we're focusing on the humoral response, which is the antibody response, but there may be a component of a cellular response that, you know, we just do not know. We don't know anything. We have such limited knowledge. But, you know, in a pandemic, you have to just keep moving forward. So it's based on what other, you know, the most likely scenario is based on other viruses.
Okay, and last little line of questioning here before we go. I mentioned to you guys, you know, 4 or 5 weeks ago about systems that were being put into place in other countries to do contact tracing. It seemed sort of speculative for the United States at the time, but now states are hiring. I mean, you can go online and there are listings for jobs called contact tracers. You know, what do you think about that? And do you know if there's anything going on in Florida or Southwest Florida to ramp up for that?
Well, I think it's a fantastic idea. I don't know if it's what's going on locally, but that's the way to go. You need to know who's infected and who they've been in contact with. That's the only way to prevent something for which we don't have a specific treatment or a current vaccine right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Department of Health's job. I mean, that's when you have syphilis and, you know, they go out and they interview you and they find out who your sexual contacts are and they go out and trace those people down. That's bread and butter epidemiology.
All right. Well, I'm going to try to find somebody from the health department in Florida to talk about that because I just read, I guess, the state of New York just hired 1,000 contact tracers and are looking to hire more.
Right.
So.
Right. So, I mean, clearly, the health department is not set up to do it at that scale, as you know. But that's the way we do. You know, there's other infectious diseases that, you know, you do tuberculosis, for example. You know, you send out the band. When you find a case of tuberculosis, you do the exact same thing. You isolate the person, you contain that person, and then you go out looking for contacts. And that's exactly what the Department of Health does.